Welcome to the Permatemp Corporation. A presentation of the audio podcast, This Is Actually Happening. Episode 52. What if you found yourself in a dark, strange land?
I was going to college, and I had student deferment. Vietnam was going on, and I left school, so I applied for a job. I'm only 18, and nobody will give me a job. And they said, yeah, we'll hire you. He says, but we can't hire you. You're 1A status. You can be drafted anytime. And I got to the point that I can't get a job, and I'm not in school. I can't make any money, so the service was, a viable option at that time. And I went in March, and I found out later in May that my number was 65 that year, and I would have been drafted because we were drafting up to about 120 in my neighborhood. And my mother was, at the time, she says, if you want to go into service, I says, you're right, you do what you want, but I didn't raise you to get killed in a rice paddy. I signed up for the Navy at first. They thought I had a heart murmur. Turned out I was a long distance runner. I just had a very strong heart. And they actually called my mother up and said, so we want him into the Polaris nuclear sub program. And they said, well, it's too bad because he's in Texas in boot camp for the Air Force. I was interested in medical training. And so like I went to boot camp in San Antonio, then went to med school up in Wichita Falls, and then wind up on the Mexican border in Laredo, Texas, for 2.5 years and stuff. And how I actually wound up getting to Greenland was I was so tired of the desert, so I said, I just want something different. And so I applied for any place but Texas or another desert outpost, and I got the direct opposite. I was up in northern Greenland at Thule Air Base. I was a medical technician in the Air Force. I think it's around 600-700 miles from the North Pole. And I was up there for a good year. Yeah, I was 21, I believe, at the time. And Greenland was a territory of Denmark. And so Danes would run the base. We would take care of all the military stuff that was going on there. So it was a huge radar installation. It's part of the old NORAD system for if there were Soviet ICBMs coming over the North Pole, we would be one of the first alerts to let them know that missiles were coming. And it was already antiquated when I got there and stuff. For some reason, they still wanted to keep it. It's very austere. There are no trees. Most of them were all Danes living there, but there were some Danes who would intermarry with the Greenlanders, when they traded furs and tusks and so on for souvenirs. I had to take care of a couple of them that would get injured out hunting or something. I had one boy, he was in a tent, little Eskimo boy, and he had burns all over his hands because the tent caught fire. And so I would take care of him. And they were, generally speaking, I would say they were kind of looked down on by a lot of the Danes and stuff. Some yes, some no. They had a huge propensity to develop alcoholism, and it was strictly forbidden to give them any alcohol. But they were always laughing. They were always laughing. They always smiled and would wave to you if you saw dog sleds coming by or what have you. And very talkative, very nice. But I just was always amazed that humans could get by in that sort of environment. It's a place you won't ever see any place else on the earth. You can take your jacket off in wintertime and be dead in 15 minutes. It's very unforgiving if you make mistakes. Winters, it can get down to 60, 70 below zero. Late October to early March, you see no sun. Very strange experience not to see sun. What would happen is that then there would be one day that you wouldn't see the sun, and it would glow just a small section of the sky. It looked like morning was coming up, but you wouldn't see the sun. And then as the weeks and months progressed, that nice glow that you used to see on part of the sky got dimmer and dimmer and dimmer until, like, right in the middle of winter, at least as far up as we were, nothing. Just total darkness. When you do see sun, it's like for the first time after, you know, several months, it's like a religious experience. When you don't see sun for, you know, for 4 or 5 months, and then you see it, it's kind of like, it's amazing. Around probably the month of May, June, when you start getting 24-hour daylight. So it's a strange thing if you haven't seen it. Sun just doesn't go down. And there's not a lot to do up there aside from your function. Most of the people getting drunk on the weekends, and because there's just not much up there. And it's very desolate. It's like being on another planet. Yeah, I used to go off by myself, and I'd look, climb on the top of a mountain, and all you ever hear, it's the only place I've ever seen it, you hear nothing except the wind and your breathing, and that's it. And it's, I always thought, I said, this is like, if you could breathe on Mars, this must be what it's like. And it's also so clear, because there was no pollution up there, that you had to watch out for the optical illusions. An island that might be, looked like maybe 4 or 5 miles away, was actually 10 miles away. You get bored up there, so you have to, if you're not somebody who prefers to spend most of his time drinking and bitching and stuff, but you did stuff. You know, I used to like hiking a lot. I taught myself a lot up there. I taught myself literature, opera, everything else. So I just looked at it as, okay, there's no women around. That sucks. I'm gonna make the best usage of it I can. I loved the 24-hour daylight, but when it was dark out there, there wasn't that much you could do. I actually cut down a couple of suicides up there. Some people couldn't take it. A lot of the GIs would get their Dear John letters up there. And occasionally, I remember one guy, and he had been drinking at the NCO club, and they gave taxis in between all the buildings because, you know, the danger of freezing to death. And this guy sat down, and he never woke up again. And when we found him, he was frozen solid. You know, it's sort of like if you obeyed all the rules and didn't take any risks, you were fine. But if you were, I can walk that mile to back to my barracks or something, and probably was ate too much, drank too much, and just decided to sit down on one of these tubes and fell asleep. And he was frozen solid. So whenever I got a chance to do anything, if I had a day off or a couple of days off, I would always take advantage of that. And there was a couple, two scientists, John and Diane, and they were up studying walruses. And I had seen most of the wildlife out there, rabbits, fox, whales, seals, you name it. I had probably seen it, but I didn't see walruses, and I knew they were going up, and they were going to do on the weekend 2 trips up there. So I had some medical supplies, made an excuse, asked if I could go, and they said, as long as you don't get in trouble, yeah, go. It's fine to do that. I had to take must have been a 35-mile rough road excursion to their site. I want to see the walruses because they're unusual in that you can see other animals up there, sea creatures, but walruses are very avoidant of people. They wouldn't come near the base, so it was the only place I knew that you could probably see them. So I went out there, and they were on it was like an island, maybe 2 or 3 acres, less than 1/4 mile out, and you could actually walk out to it on low tide. And they had an observation shack there. And the observation shack was not very big, but the size of a living room. So we started moving stuff out, you know, from the truck to the shack, talked to them for a couple of hours, got really interested in the studying, and then watching the walruses. And I used to trade ivory. It used to be legal
You know, if I was hoping maybe there'd be some old skulls or something around. And I said, well, the truck's coming, it's going back today, but it's coming back tomorrow. Would you mind if I stayed over? And they agreed to that. And when the truck had left, it was must have been, I don't know, somewhere in the afternoon. And that's when I had seen a polar bear about probably about a quarter mile off. And it was kind of walking, you know, along the water's edge towards that little island. And I talked to John. I says, that's a polar bear, isn't it? And he goes, yeah. And so he went in, got his shotgun, and just watched it. And it was watching us. It was kind of going back and forth. It's kind of like, it seemed like it was scoping us out. And he had said it had been around a few times before, and they kind of yelled at it and threw stones ineffectively at it and stuff, and it seemed to get bored and then went off. And so we stayed near that night, and they had a sleeping bag, so, and it's cold even with the insulation. It's just kind of like a small wooden structure with canvas and poor insulation on it. I remember saying, what's the chance of the polar bear coming back? He says, you never know. And we wound up going to sleep, and you had to kind of close all the windows because you got light coming in all the time. Even in my barracks at the base, we would put aluminum foil up just so we could sleep at night because, you know, most people don't sleep well in daylight. And so anyways, we wound up going to bed, and then it was sometime early in the morning, John all of a sudden, you know, shakes me. I'm half awake anyways. He says, get up, there's something moving outside. And then Diane got up, and we don't hear anything for a bit, and all of a sudden there's things being knocked around outside. I think there were some canisters next to the shack or something that were knocking around. And so John goes, he gets the shotgun, and he tells me, the other rifle's over there. And I think it was like 30-06 or something. And he says, just keep quiet. And Diane's like frozen, I'm frozen. And all of a sudden, you hear this like slash. This whole side of the structure by the door ripped a diagonal slash right through the tent, opened the whole side of it up. And like the light comes coming in there, and it's that bear. I'm saying, like, holy shit. I guess, like, and I'm thinking to myself, geez, I'm a kid, I'm 21, I'm from a poor section of Boston, and I'm going to get eaten by a polar bear. I go, like, this is very surreal. This is like, and this only goes through like a second, you know, through your head, and you're going, like, oh, you know what, you know, like, this is it. I was in high school 3 years ago, and I'm going to get eaten by a polar bear. How do you do this? You know, how do you get into this type of a situation? You know, one of these things where you get to face your mortality right there. You know, and for some reason, it was sort of like, I was scared, but I wasn't. You know, it's sort of like you go on autopilot, and I guess this one was about 8 feet tall. It's a big truck with claws on it, and you don't negotiate with them. What really scared the hell out of us, if that wasn't enough, is that they had a door to this shack. It was an aluminum door, not very thick. That thing comes crashing down, and what had happened is this polar bear just pushed on it and knocked the door down. He didn't slash it. He just knocked it down, and the whole shack, which had been kind of dark, but everything's lit up. And John's on his knees, like almost in a, like one knee up and one knee down, and the polar bear's got half of its head in the shack and it is about to raise up. And he lets the polar bear have it, both barrels, the force of the two shells hit him in the chest, and it wasn't carefully aimed. That's just where he hit him. But when he hit the bear, what it did is, like, I figured it was going to fall in. It just kind of fell over, writhed a little bit, and we all didn't do anything for a couple of minutes. And we waited, And after about 10 minutes and stuff, we didn't see much, and you could see the blood gushing out over on the white fur onto the ground there. And I'm going like, whoa, this is something else and stuff, I goes like, and I'm technically not even supposed to be out there and stuff. I kind of wormed my way in there, and I believe he had shot it in the lung or the heart. He got it in a really vital area, because it didn't, rattle on or just struggle. It was just dead. And I went out and I was just flabbergasted by it. And the thing I remember most was I went up to the front paw, picked it up, and the pad, not even the individual small one, the claw, the pad was huge. It was like a big dinner plate. It was probably, I would say at least, it was more than 12 inches round. It was just huge. I just was surprised, and they're able, from what I hear from Eskimos, to just basically, they can rip off a seal's head just like that. They're also incredibly smart, and they've been known to hang around a breathing hole that the seals have when the ocean freezes. They'll have a hole that they come up and breathe. And I was told by the hunters that they can actually sit still for 6-7 hours, perfectly still, waiting for that seal to jump out or just to breathe, and they'll just kind of whoop. The seal will take care of them for a while. So we had to call in before the truck came back in. We told them, so we had a polar bear attack, and they had to get some repair material, and in addition to the stuff that was being bought back. And I told them, I said, call Aratuck. Aratuck was a hunter who lived in a village right next to the air base. I'd been out with him a few times, and he used to be called the greatest hunter in northern Greenland, for polar bear hunters. We told him, I says, we shot one. And he says, and ask him if he wants to get onto the truck and come and get it. And some hours later, Aratuck came. He skinned it, wenched it up onto the truck. We took the rest of the supplies off and took the 30-40 mile trip back to the base again. But we dropped off the polar bear at his village, because they use it for pants. It's highly valued. It's very difficult and very dangerous to hunt. And you think it's soft, and it's like steel wool. It's really thick, and underneath it's an incredible insulator, which is why the men always wear the polar bear pants and stuff. The women have seal skin usually, so they wound up cutting up the meat and using that. And I actually had for some years. I had like about 6 square inches of it. Stuff just as a souvenir. As much as humans have made and stuff, it's just like Mother Nature tells us what to do, not the other way around. We think we control nature, but we really don't. And when you see it in its glory and its fury, it leaves you with, you don't really know what bad times are. You don't know what a being in a really, a dark and strange land is like. When that happened, I said, this is reality, this is real life. Growing up in the city as I did, and I still feel this way, is that civilization is just artificial. We're very intelligent creatures. We build these cities and stuff, but you know what? Nature, polar bears, tsunamis, earthquakes, volcanoes, you name it, can just wipe out your sense of comfort. That this is a very different place. It was reality to me. You kind of go through the motions, and then you realize what happened. It kind of confirmed to me how tenuous our hold on life is. It sounds kind of funny, but I've had a few other close calls, not with animals, but a few other times where I almost fell off a cliff up there, and it kind of leaves you realizing how tenuous our hold on life is. You can go at any time. To see an animal that huge, and to think that, just by sheer luck, if he hadn't hit that polar bear just the way he did and kill it, we could have all been mush in somebody's, in an animal's stomach.